down her stomach. He picked up a scalpel and again made a quick cut to open up the chest. The rest was as before. The silent scream, the convulsing body, guts spilling out. Pulling out the bloody heart, showing it to Nakata, popping it into his mouth, chewing it slowly. The satisfied smile. Wiping away the blood with the back of his hand. All with hey-ho as background music. Nakata sank back in his chair and closed his eyes. He held his head in his hands, the fingertips digging into his temples. Something was definitely rising up within him, a horrible confusion transforming his very being. He was breathing rapidly, and a sharp pain throbbed in his neck. His vision was changing drastically.
"Mr. Nakata," Johnny Walker said brightly, "don't collapse on me yet. We're just getting to the main event. That was only the opening act, a mere warm-up. Now we're getting to the lineup, you know. So open your eyes wide and take a good long look. This is the best part. I hope you'll appreciate how hard I've tried to make this entertaining for you."
Whistling his tune, he took out the next cat. Sunk in his chair, Nakata opened his eyes and looked at the next victim. His mind was a complete blank, and he couldn't even stand up.
"I believe you already know each other," Johnny Walker said, "but I'll do the honors anyway. Mr. Nakata, this is Mr. Kawamura. Mr. Kawamura, Mr. Nakata."
Johnny Walker tipped his hat in a theatrical gesture, greeting first Nakata, then the paralyzed cat.
"Now that you've said hello, I'm afraid we move right into farewells. Hello, goodbye. Like flowers scattered in a storm, man's life is one long farewell, as they say."
He gave Kawamura's soft stomach a gentle caress. "Now's the time to stop me if you're going to, Mr. Nakata. Time's ticking away, and I won't hesitate. In the dictionary of the infamous cat-killer Johnny Walker, hesitate is one word you won't find." And indeed, without any hesitation at all, he slit open Kawamura's belly. This time the scream was audible. Maybe the cat's tongue hadn't been fully paralyzed, or perhaps it was a special kind of scream that only Nakata could hear. An awful, blood-curdling scream. Nakata closed his eyes and held his trembling head in his hands.
"You have to look," Johnny Walker commanded. "That's another one of our rules. Closing your eyes isn't going to change anything. Nothing's going to disappear just because you can't see what's going on. In fact, things will be even worse the next time you open your eyes. That's the kind of world we live in, Mr. Nakata. Keep your eyes wide open. Only a coward closes his eyes. Closing your eyes and plugging up your ears won't make time stand still."
Nakata did as he was told and opened his eyes. Once he was sure they were open, Johnny Walker made a show of devouring Kawamura's heart, taking more time than before to savor it.
"It's soft and warm, just like fresh eel liver," Johnny Walker commented. He then lifted a bloody index finger to his mouth and sucked it. "Once you've acquired a taste for this, you get hooked, especially the sticky blood."
He wiped the blood off the scalpel, whistling cheerily as always, and sawed off Kawamura's head. The fine teeth of the blade cut through the bone, and blood spurted everywhere.
"Please, Mr. Walker, Nakata can't stand it any more."
Johnny Walker stopped whistling. He halted his work and scratched an earlobe.
"That won't wash, Mr. Nakata. I'm sorry you feel bad, I really am, but I can't just say, 'Okay, we'll do,' and call this off. I told you, this is war. It's hard to stop a war once it starts. Once the sword is drawn, blood's going to be spilled. This doesn't have anything to do with theory or logic or even my ego. It's just a rule, pure and simple. If you don't want any more cats to be killed, you've got to kill me. Stand up. Focus your hatred and strike me down. And you've got to do it now. Do that, and it's all over. End of story."
Johnny Walker started whistling again. He finished cutting off Kawamura's head and tossed the headless body into the bin bag. Now there were three heads lined up on the metal tray. They'd suffered such agony, yet their faces were as strangely vacant as those of the cats lined up in the freezer.
"Next comes the Siamese."
Johnny Walker said this and extracted a limp Siamese from his bag, which of course turned out to be Mimi.
So now we come to little Mi chiamano Mimi, from the Puccini opera. This little cat really does have that elegant coquetry, doesn't she? I'm a big Puccini fan myself. Puccini's music is somewhat, what should I call it, eternally antagonistic to the times. Mere popular entertainment, you might argue, but it never gets old. Quite an artistic accomplishment. He whistled a bar of Mi chiamano Mimi. But I have to tell you, Mr. Nakata, it took some doing to catch Mimi. She's clever and cautious, very quick on the draw, not the type to get suckered into anything. One tough customer. But the cat that can elude Johnny Walker, the matchless cat killer, has yet to be born. Not that I'm bragging or anything. I'm just trying to convey how hard it was to nab her. At any rate, voila. Your friend Mimi. Siamese are my absolute favourites. You're not aware of this, but a Siamese cat's heart is a real gem. Sort of like truffles. It's okay, Mimi. Never fear. Johnny Walker's here, ready to enjoy your warm, delicious little heart. Ah, you're trembling. Johnny Walker. From deep inside himself, Nakata managed to force out the words in a low voice. Please stop it. If you don't, Nakata's going to go crazy. I don't feel myself any more. Johnny Walker laid Mimi on the desk, and out of habit let his fingers slowly crawl along her belly. So you're no longer yourself, he said carefully and quietly. That's very important, Mr. Nakata, a person not being himself any more. He picked up a scalpel he hadn't yet used, and tested its sharpness with the tip of his finger. Then, as if doing a trial cut, he ran the blade along the back of his hand. A moment later, blood oozed up, dripping onto the desk and Mimi's body. Johnny Walker chuckled. A person's not being himself any more, he repeated. You're no longer yourself. That's the ticket, Mr. Nakata. Wonderful. The most important thing of all. Oh, full of scorpions is my mind. Macbeth again. Without a word, Nakata stood up. No one, not even Nakata himself, could have stopped him. With long strides, he walked over to the desk and grabbed what looked like a steak knife. Grasping the wooden handle firmly, he plunged the blade into Johnny Walker's stomach, piercing the black waistcoat, then stabbed again in another spot. He could hear something, a loud sound, and at first he didn't know what it was. But then he realized. Johnny Walker was laughing. Stabbed in the stomach and chest, his blood spouting out, he laughed and laughed. "That's the stuff!" he yelled. "You didn't hesitate! Well done!" Laughing as though this was the funniest joke he'd ever heard. Soon, though, his laughter turned into a sob. The blood gurgling in his throat sounded like a drain coming unplugged. A terrible convulsion racked his body, and blood gushed from his mouth along with dark, slimy lumps, the hearts of the cats he'd eaten. The blood spewed over the desk onto Nakata's golf shirt. Both men were drenched in blood. Mimi, too, lying on the desk, was soaked with it. Johnny Walker collapsed at Nakata's feet. He was on his side, curled up like a child on a cold night, and was unmistakably dead. His left hand was pressed against his throat, his right thrust straight out as though reaching for something. The convulsions had ceased, and, of course, the laughter. A faint sneer was still evident on his lips. Blood puddled on the wooden floor, and the silk hat had rolled off into a corner. The hair on the back of Johnny Walker's head was thin, the skin visible beneath. Without the hat he looked much older and more feeble. Nakata dropped the knife, and it clattered to the floor as loudly as the gear of some large machine clanking away in the distance. Nakata stood next to the body for a long time. Everything in the room had come to a standstill. Only the blood continued, noiselessly, to flow, the puddles spreading across the floor. At last Nakata pulled himself together and gathered up Mimi from the desk. Warm and limp in his hands, she was covered in blood, but apparently unharmed. Mimi looked at him as if trying to tell him something, but
but the drug prevented her mouth from moving. Nakata then found Goma inside the case and lifted her out. He'd only seen photos of her, but felt a wave of nostalgia, as if he was meeting a long-lost friend.
"Goma," he murmured.
Holding the two cats, Nakata sat down on the sofa.
"Let's go home," he told them,
but he couldn't stand up. The black dog had appeared from somewhere and sat down beside his dead master. He might have lapped at the pool of blood, but Nakata couldn't remember for sure. His head felt heavy and dim, and he took a deep breath and closed his eyes. His mind began to fade, and, before he knew it, sank down into the darkness.
17. It's my third night in the cabin. With each passing day, I've grown more used to the silence, and how incredibly dark it is. The night doesn't frighten me anymore, or at least not so much. I fill the stove with firewood, settle down in front of it and read. When I get tired, I just space out and stare at the flames. I never grow tired of looking at them. They come in all shapes and colors, and move around like living things. They're born, they connect up, part company, and die. When it's not cloudy, I go outside and gaze up at the sky. The stars don't seem as intimidating as before, and I'm starting to feel closer to them. Each one gives out its own special light. I identify certain stars and watch how they twinkle in the night. Every once in a while they blaze more brightly for a moment. The moon hangs there, pale and bright. And if I look closely, it's as if I can make out individual crags on the surface. I don't form any coherent thoughts, just gaze, enthralled at the sky. Having no music doesn't bother me as much as I thought it would. There's lots of other sounds that take its place. The chirping of birds, the cries of all sorts of insects, the gurgle of the brook, the rustling of leaves. Rain falls, something scrambles across the cabin roof, and sometimes I hear indescribable sounds I can't explain. I never knew the world was full of so many beautiful, natural sounds. I've ignored them my entire life, but not now. I sit on the porch for hours with my eyes closed, trying to be inconspicuous, picking up each and every sound around me. The woods don't frighten me as much as they used to either, and I've begun to feel a kind of closeness and respect. That said, I don't venture that far from the cabin, and I stay on the path. As long as I follow these rules, it shouldn't get too precarious. That's the important thing. Follow the rules, and the woods will wordlessly accept me, sharing some of their peace and beauty. Cross the line, though, and beasts of silence lie in wait to maul me with razor-sharp claws. I often lie in the little round clearing and let the sunlight wash over me. Eyes closed tight, I give myself up to it, ears tuned to the wind whipping through the treetops. Wrapped in the deep fragrance of the forest, I listen to the flapping of birds' wings, to the stirring of the ferns. I'm freed from gravity and float up, just a little, from the ground, and drift in the air. Of course, I can't stay there forever. It's a momentary sensation. Open my eyes and it's gone. Still, it's an overwhelming experience, being able to float in the air. It rains hard a couple of times, but doesn't last, and each time I run outside naked to wash myself. Sometimes I get all sweaty exercising, rip off my clothes, and sunbathe on the porch. I drink a lot of tea and concentrate on reading, sitting on the porch or by the stove. Books on history, science, folklore, mythology, sociology, psychology, Shakespeare, you name it. Instead of racing straight through, I reread parts I think are the most important till I understand them, to get something tangible out of them. All sorts of knowledge seeps bit by bit into my brain. I imagine how great it'd be to stay here as long as I wanted. There are lots of books on the shelf I'd like to read, still plenty of food. But I know I'm just passing through, and will have to leave before long. This place is too calm, too natural, too complete. I don't deserve it. At least, not yet. On the fourth day, Oshima turns up late in the morning. I'm stark naked, sprawled on the chair on the porch, dozing in the sun, and don't hear him approach. I don't hear the sound of his car. Shouldering a backpack, he's walked here from the road. He steps quietly onto the porch, sticks out his hand, and lightly brushes my head. Startled, I leap to my feet and scramble around for a towel. There isn't one handy. "Don't worry about it," Oshima says. "When I stayed here, I used to sunbathe nude all the time. It feels great, having the sun on places it never reaches." Naked like this in front of him, I feel defenseless and vulnerable. My pubic hair, penis, balls, all exposed. I have no idea what to do. It's a little late to cover up. "Hi," I say, straining to sound casual. "So you walked up?" "It's such a nice day, I decided to," he says. "I left the car down by the gate." He takes a towel draped over the railing and hands it to me. I wrap it round my waist and can finally relax. Singing a song in a low voice, he boils water, then takes out flour, eggs, and milk from his pack and whips up some pancakes in the frying pan. Tops these with butter and syrup. Then he takes out lettuce, tomatoes, and an onion. He's very careful with the kitchen knife as he chops everything up for a salad. We have all this for lunch. "So how were your 3 days here?" he asks, cutting a pancake. I tell him what a wonderful time I had. I omit the part about going into the woods. Somehow it's better not to talk about it. "I'm glad," Oshima says. "I was hoping you'd like it here." "But we're going back to the city now, aren't we?" "That's right. It's time to go back." Getting ready to leave, we briskly straighten up the cabin, wash the dishes and put them away on the shelves, clean up the stove, empty the water pail, shut the valve in the propane tank, store the food that will last in the cupboard, throw the rest away, sweep the floor, wipe off the tabletops and chairs, dig a hole outside to bury the rubbish. As Oshima locks up the cabin, I turn to look one last time. Until a minute ago, it felt so real, but now it seems imaginary. Just a few steps is all it takes for everything associated with it to lose all sense of reality. And me, the person who was there until a moment ago now, I now seem imaginary too. It takes 30 minutes to walk to where Oshima parked the car, and we hardly exchange a word as we go down the mountain road. Oshima's humming some melody. I let my mind wander. At the bottom, the little green sports car blends into the background of the forest. Oshima closes the gate to discourage trespassers, wraps the chain around it twice, and locks the padlock. As before, I secure my backpack to the rack on the back of the car. The top's down this time. "Back to the city," Oshima says. I nod. "I'm sure you enjoyed living all alone with nature like that, but it's not easy to live there for a long time," Oshima says. He puts on sunglasses and fastens his seatbelt. I get into the car beside him and snap on my seatbelt. "In theory, it's not impossible to live like that, and of course there are people who do. But nature is actually unnatural in a way, and relaxation can be threatening. It takes experience and preparation to really live with those contradictions. So we're going back to the city for the time being, back to civilization." Oshima starts the engine, and we head down the mountain road. This time he's in no hurry, and drives at a leisurely pace, enjoying the scenery and the rush of wind that whips through his fringe. The unpaved road ends, and we start down the narrow paved road, passing villages and fields. "Speaking of contradictions," Oshima suddenly says, "when I first met you, I felt a kind of contradiction in you. You're seeking something, but at the same time, you're running away for all you're worth." "What is it I'm looking for?" Oshima shakes his head. He glances in the rearview mirror and frowns. "I have no idea. I'm only saying that was the impression I had." I don't reply. From my own experience, when someone is trying very hard to get something, they don't. And when they're running away from something as hard as they can, it usually catches up with them. I'm generalizing, of course. If you generalize about me, then, what's in my future? If I'm seeking and running at the same time? That's a tough one, Oshima says and smiles. A moment passes before he goes on. If I had to say anything, it'd be this. Whatever it is you're seeking won't come in the form you're expecting. Rather an ominous prophecy. Like Cassandra. Cassandra, I ask. The Greek tragedy. Cassandra was the queen of Troy who prophesied. She was a temple priestess, and Apollo gave her the power to predict fate. In return, he tried to force her to sleep with him, but she refused, and he put a curse on her. Greek gods are more mythological than religious figures. By that, I mean they have the same character flaws humans do. They fly off the handle, get randy, jealous, forgetful, you name it. He takes a small box of lemon drops out of the glove compartment and pops one in his mouth. He motions for me to take one, and I do. What kind of curse was it? The curse on Cassandra? I nod. The curse Apollo laid on her was that all her prophecies would come true, but that nobody would ever believe them. On top of which, her prophecies would all be unlucky ones. Predictions of betrayals, accidents, deaths, the country falling into ruin, that sort of thing. People not only didn't believe her, they began to despise her. If you haven't read them yet, I really recommend the plays by Euripides or Aeschylus. They deal with a lot of the essential problems we struggle with even today. In Koros. Koros? What's that? That's what they called the chorus they used in Greek plays. They stand at the back of the stage and explain in unison the situation or what the characters are feeling deep inside. Sometimes they even try to influence the characters. It's a very convenient device. Sometimes I wish I had my own chorus standing behind me. Are you able to prophesy? No such luck, he smiles. For better or for worse, I don't have that kind of power. If I sound as if I'm always predicting ominous things, it's because I'm a pragmatist. I use deductive reasoning to generalize, and I suppose this sometimes ends up sounding like unlucky prophecies. You know why? Because reality's just the accumulation of ominous prophecies come to life. You have only to open a newspaper on any given day and weigh the good news versus the bad, and you'll see what I mean. Oshima carefully changes gear at each curve, the kind of practiced gear changing you hardly notice. Only the change in the sound of the engine gives it away. There is one piece of good news, though, he says. We've decided to take you in. You'll be a staff member of the Komura Memorial Library, which I think you're qualified for. Instinctively, I glance at him. You mean I'm going to be working at the library? More precisely, from now on, you'll be a part of the library. You're going to be staying in the library, living there. You'll open the doors when it's time for the library to open, shut them when it's time to close up. As I said before, you seem to be a pretty self-disciplined sort of person, and fairly strong, so I don't imagine the job will be very difficult for you. Miss Saiki and I aren't all that strong physically, so it'll really help us out a lot. Other than that, you'll just help with small day-to-day things. Nothing to speak of, really. Making delicious coffee for me. Going out shopping for us. We've prepared a room that's attached to the library for you to stay in. It was originally a guest room, but we don't have any guests staying over, so it hasn't been used for a long time. That's where you'll live. It has its own shower, too. The best thing is that you'll be in the library, so you can read whatever you like. But why? I begin to say, but can't finish. Why are we doing this? It's based on a very simple principle. I understand you, and Miss Saiki understands me. I accept you, and she accepts me. So even if you're some unknown 15-year-old runaway, that's not a problem. So what do you think? I give it some thought. All I was looking for was a roof over my head. That's all that matters right now. I don't really know what it means to become part of the library, but if it means I can live there, I'm grateful. At least I won't have to commute anymore. Then it's settled, Oshima says. Let's go to the library then, so you can become a part of it. We joined the highway and passed a number of towns. A giant billboard for a loan company, a petrol station with gaudy decorations, a glass-enclosed restaurant, a love hotel made up to look like a European castle, an abandoned video shop with only its sign left, a pachinko place with an enormous car park, McDonald's, 7-Eleven, Yoshinoya, Denny's. Noisy reality starts to surround us. The hiss of 18-wheelers' air brakes, horns and exhaust. Everything near me until now, the fire in the stove, the twinkle of the stars, the stillness of the forest, has faded away. I find it hard even to imagine them. There are a couple of things you should know about Miss Saiki, Oshima says. When she was little, my mother and Miss Saiki were classmates and very close. She says that Miss Saiki was a bright little girl. She got good grades, was good at composition, sports of all kinds, and could play the piano well too. She was the best at whatever she tried, and beautiful. Of course, she's still quite a stunning person. I nod. When she was still in grade school, she had a sweetheart, the eldest son of the Komura family. A distant relative, actually. They were the same age and made a handsome couple, a regular Romeo and Juliet. They lived near each other and were never apart. And when they became adults, they fell in love. They were like one body and one spirit, according to my mother. We're waiting at a red light, and Oshima looks up at the sky. When the signal turns green, he accelerates hard and we zoom out in front of a tanker. Do you remember what I told you in the library? About how people are always wandering around, searching for their other half? That part about male-male, female-female, and male-females. Right. What Aristophanes said. How we stumble through our lives, desperately fumbling for our other half. Miss Saiki and that young man never had to do that. They were born with their other half right there in front of them. They were lucky. Oshima nods. Absolutely. Up to a point. He rubs his chin with his palm, as if he's checking how well he shaved. There's no trace of a razor. His skin is as smooth as porcelain. When the young man was 18, he went to Tokyo to go to college. He had good grades and a degree course he was interested in. He also wanted to see what the big city was like. She went to a local college and studied the piano. This is a conservative part of the country, and she came from an old-fashioned kind of family. She was an only child, and her parents didn't want her going off to Tokyo. So the two were separated for the first time in their lives, as though God had cut them cleanly apart with a knife. Of course, they wrote to each other every day. It might be good for us to try being apart like this, he wrote to her. Then we can really tell how much we mean to each other. But she didn't believe that. She knew their relationship was real enough that they didn't need to go out of their way to test it. It was a one-in-a-million union, fated to be, something that could never be broken apart. She was absolutely sure of that. But he wasn't. Or maybe he was, but simply didn't accept it. So he went ahead and left for Tokyo, thinking that overcoming a few obstacles would strengthen their love for each other. Men are like that sometimes. When she was 19, Miss Saiki wrote a poem, set it to music, and played the piano and sang it. It was a melancholy melody, innocent and lovely. The lyrics, on the other hand, were symbolic, contemplative, hard to work out. The contrast gave the song a kind of spirit and immediacy. Of course, the whole song, lyrics and melody, was her way of crying out to her boyfriend so far away. She sang the song a few times in front of people. She was ordinarily shy, but she loved to sing, and had even been in a folk music band at college. Someone was very impressed by the song, made a demo tape, and sent it to a friend of his, who was a director at a record company. He loved the song, and persuaded her to go to their studio in Tokyo and record it. It was her first time in Tokyo, and she was able to see her boyfriend. Between recording sessions, they were able to love each other as before. My mother said she thought they'd had a sexual relationship since they were around 14. Both were rather precocious, and like many precocious young people, they found it hard to grow up. It was as if they were eternally 14 or 15. They clung to each other, and felt again the intensity of their love. Neither one of them had ever been attracted to anyone else. Even apart, no one else could ever come between them. Sorry, am I boring you with this fairy tale romance? I shake my head. I have a feeling you're about to come to a turning point. You're right, Oshima says. That's how stories happen, with a turning point, an unexpected twist. There's only one kind of happiness, but misfortune comes in all shapes and sizes. It's as Tolstoy said, happiness is an allegory, unhappiness a story. Anyway, the record went on sale and was a huge hit. It kept on selling. 1 million copies, 2 million. I'm not sure of the exact figure. At any rate, it was a record-breaking number at the time. Her photo was on the record sleeve, a picture of her seated at a grand piano in the studio, smiling at the camera. She hadn't prepared any other songs, so the B-side of the single was an instrumental version of the same song, with a piano and orchestra, she, of course, playing the piano. A beautiful performance. It was around 1970. The song was on all the radio stations at the time, my mother said. This was before I was born, so I don't know for sure. This was her one and only song as a professional singer. She didn't put out an LP or a follow-up single. I wonder if I've heard that song. Do you listen to the radio much? I shake my head. I hardly ever listen to the radio. You probably haven't heard it, then. Unless it's on some oldies station, chances are you haven't. But it's a wonderful song. I have it on a CD, and listen to it every once in a while. When Miss Saiki's not around, of course. She hates any mention of the song. She doesn't like anyone bringing up the past. What's the name of the song? Kafka on the Shore, Oshima says. Kafka on the Shore. That's correct, Kafka Tamura. The same name as you. A strange coincidence, don't you think? But Kafka isn't my real name. Tamura is, though. But you chose it, right? I nod. I decided a long time ago that this was the right name for the new me. That's the point, I'd say, Oshima says. Miss Saiki's boyfriend died when he was 20, Oshima goes on. Just when Kafka on the Shore was a hit. His college was on strike during the period of student unrest and shut down. He went to bring supplies to a friend of his who was manning the barricades some time before 10 one night. The students, occupying the building, mistook him for a leader of an opposing faction. He did look a lot like him. And grabbed him, tied him to a chair, and interrogated him as a spy. He tried to explain that they'd made a mistake, but every time he did, they smashed him with a steel pipe or baton. When he fell to the floor, they'd kick him with their boots. By dawn, he was dead. His skull was caved in, his ribs broken, his lungs ruptured. They tossed his corpse out onto the street like a dead dog. 2 days later, the college asked the National Guard to come in, and within a couple of hours, the student revolt was put down, and several of them were arrested and charged with murder. The students confessed what they'd done, and were put on trial. But since it wasn't premeditated, 2 of them were convicted of involuntary manslaughter, and given short prison sentences. His death was totally pointless. Miss Saiki never sang again. She locked herself in her room, and wouldn't talk to anybody, even on the phone. She didn't go to his funeral, and dropped out of college. After a few months, people suddenly realized she was no longer in town. Nobody knows where she went or what she did. Her parents refused to discuss it. Maybe even they didn't know where she'd been. She vanished into thin air. Even her best friend, Oshima's mother, didn't have a clue. Rumors flew that she'd been committed to a mental hospital after a failed suicide attempt in the deep forests surrounding Mount Fuji. Others said a friend of a friend had spotted her on the streets of Tokyo. According to this person, she was working in Tokyo as a writer or something. Other rumors had it that she was married and had a child. There was never any evidence, though, to support these stories. 20 years passed. No matter where she was, or what she was doing all this time, Miss Saiki didn't want for money. Her royalties for Kafka on the Shore were deposited in a bank account, and even after taxes, they still amounted to a substantial sum. She got royalties every time the song was played on the radio, or included in an oldies compilation. So it was simple for her to live far away, out of the limelight. Besides, her family was rich, and she was their only daughter. Suddenly, though, 25 years later, Miss Saiki reappeared in Takamatsu. The ostensible reason was her mother's death. Her father had died 5 years before, but she hadn't come to the funeral. She held a small service for her mother and then, after things had quietened down, sold the house she'd been born and raised in. She moved into an apartment she bought in a quiet part of the city and seemed to settle down again. After a time, she had some talks with the Komura family. The head of the family, after the death of the eldest son, was his younger brother, 3 years younger. It was just the two of them, and no one knows what they talked about exactly. The upshot was that Miss Saiki became head of the Komura Library. Even now, she's slim and beautiful, and has the same neat, smart look you see on the record sleeve of Kafka on the Shore. But there's one thing missing. That lovely, innocent smile. She still smiles from time to time. Definitely a charming smile, but it's always limited somehow. A smile that never goes beyond the moment. A high, invisible wall surrounds her, keeping people at arm's length. Every morning, she drives her grey Volkswagen Golf to the library and drives it back home in the evening. In her hometown, she has very little to do with former friends and relatives. If they should meet, she makes polite conversation, but this seldom goes beyond a few standard topics. If the past happens to come up, especially if it involves her, she makes a quick, smooth segue to another topic. She's always courteous and kind, but her words lack the kind of curiosity and excitement you'd normally expect. Her true feelings, assuming such things exist, remain hidden. Save for when a practical decision has to be made, she never gives her personal opinion about anything. She seldom talks about herself, instead letting others talk, nodding warmly as she listens. Most people, though, start to feel vaguely uneasy when talking to her, as if they suspect they're wasting her time, trampling on her private, graceful, dignified world. And that impression is, for the most part, correct. So, even after settling into her hometown, she remained a cipher. A stylish woman wrapped in refined mystery. Something about her made it hard to approach her. Even her nominal employers, the Komura family, kept their distance. Eventually, Oshima became her assistant and started to work in the library. At the time, Oshima wasn't working or going to college, just staying at home, reading and listening to music. Except for a few people he exchanged emails with, he hardly had any friends. Because of his hemophilia, he spent a lot of time going to see a specialist at the hospital, riding around town in his Mazda Miata, and except for his regular appointments at the university hospital in Hiroshima, and the occasional stay at the cabin in the Kochi Mountains, he never left town. Not to imply that he was unhappy with this life. One day, Oshima's mother happened to introduce him to Miss Saiki, who took an instant liking to him. The feeling was mutual, and the notion of working in a library intrigued him. Oshima soon became the only person Miss Saiki would normally deal with or speak to. "Sounds to me as though Miss Saiki came back here to become head of the library," I say. I'd have to agree. Her mother's funeral was just the occasion that brought her back. Her hometown must be so full of bittersweet memories that I imagine it was a hard decision to return. Why was the library so important to her? Her boyfriend used to live in a building that's part of the library now. He was the eldest Komura son, and a love of reading was in his blood, I suppose. He liked to be alone, another family trait. So when he went into junior high, he insisted on living apart from the main house, in a separate building, and his parents gave their okay. The whole family loved reading, so they could understand where he was coming from. If you want to be surrounded by books, it's fine with us, that kind of thing. So he lived in that annex, with nobody bothering him, coming back to the main house only for meals. Miss Saiki went to see him there almost every day. The two of them studied together, listened to music, and talked forever. And most likely made love there. The place was their own bit of paradise. Both hands resting on top of the steering wheel, Oshima looks over at me. That's where you'll be living now, Kafka. In that room. As I said, the library's been renovated, but it's the very same room. Silence on my part. Miss Saiki's life basically stopped at 20 when her lover died. No, maybe not at 20. Maybe much earlier. I don't know the details, but you need to be aware of this. The hands of the clock buried inside her soul, ground to a halt then. Time outside, of course, flows on as always, but she isn't affected by it. For her, what we consider normal time is essentially meaningless. Meaningless? Oshima nods. As if it doesn't exist. What you're saying is that Miss Saiki still lives in that frozen time. Exactly. I'm not saying she's a living corpse or anything like that. When you get to know her better, you'll understand. Oshima reaches out and lays a hand on my knee in a totally natural gesture. Kafka, in everybody's life, there's a point of no return. And in a very few cases, a point where you can't go forward anymore. And when we reach that point, all we can do is quietly accept the fact. That's how we survive. We're about to join the main highway. Before we do, Oshima stops the car, puts up the top, and slips the Schubert Sonata into the CD player. There's one other thing I'd like you to be aware of, he goes on. Miss Saiki has a wounded heart. To some extent, that's true of all of us, present company included. But Miss Saiki has a special, individual wound that goes beyond the usual meaning of the term. Her soul moves in mysterious ways. I'm not saying she's dangerous, don't get me wrong. On a day-to-day level, she's definitely got her act together, probably more than anybody else I know. She's charming, deep, intelligent. But just don't let it bother you if you notice something odd about her sometimes. Odd, I can't help asking. Oshima shakes his head. I really like Miss Saiki, and respect her. I'm sure you'll come to feel the same way. This doesn't really answer my question, but Oshima doesn't say anything. With perfect timing, he changes gear, accelerates, and passes a small van just as we enter a tunnel.
18. Nakata found himself face up in a clump of weeds. As he awakened, he slowly opened his eyes. It was night, but he couldn't see any stars or the moon. Still, the sky was faintly light. He could smell the strong scent of summer grasses and hear insects buzzing around. Somehow he was back in the vacant plot of land he'd been staking out every day. Feeling something rough and warm brush against his face, he turned and saw two cats eagerly licking both his cheeks with their tiny tongues. It was Goma and Mimi. Nakata slowly sat up, reached out and petted them.
"Was Nakata asleep?" he asked.
The cats cried out as though they were complaining about something, but Nakata couldn't catch the words. He had no idea what they were trying to tell him. They were just two cats meowing.
"I beg your pardon, but I can't understand what you're trying to say."
He stood up and checked his body to make sure there was nothing amiss. He felt no pain, and his arms and legs were working fine. His eyes took some time to adjust to the darkness, but once they did, he saw that there wasn't any blood on his arms or clothes. His clothes weren't rumpled or messed up either, and looked the same as when he'd left his apartment. His canvas bag was right there beside him, lunch and thermos inside, and his hat was inside his trouser pocket, where he belonged. Everything in order. Nakata couldn't work out what was going on. In order to save the two cats, he'd stabbed Johnny Walker, the cat killer, to death. That much he remembered all too clearly. He could still feel the knife in his hands. It wasn't a dream. Blood had spurted out of Johnny Walker, and he'd collapsed to the floor, curled up and died. Then Nakata had sunk back on the sofa and lost consciousness. And the next thing he knew, here he was lying among the weeds in the vacant plot of land. But how did he get back here? He didn't even know the road back. And his clothes had no blood on them at all. Seeing Mimi and Goma beside him proved it wasn't a dream. But for some strange reason, now he couldn't understand a word they said. Nakata sighed. He couldn't think straight. But never mind, he'd work it all out later. He slung the bag over his shoulder, picked up the two cats, and left the vacant plot of land. Once outside the fence, Mimi started to squirm as if she wanted to be let down. Nakata lowered her to the ground. "Mimi, you can go back home on your own, I imagine. It's nearby." "That's right," Mimi's wagging tail seemed to say.
"Nakata doesn't understand what's happened, but for some reason I can't talk to you any more. But I was able to find Goma, and I'd better take her back to the Koizumis. Everyone's waiting for her. Thank you so much for everything, Mimi."
Mimi meowed, wagged her tail again, then scurried off and disappeared round the corner. There was no blood on her, either. Nakata decided to remember that. The Koizumis were overjoyed at Goma's return. It was past 10 p.m., but the children were still up, brushing their teeth before bed. Their parents were drinking tea and watching the TV news, and they welcomed Nakata warmly. The two little girls, in pajamas, jostled each other to be the first to hug their precious pet. Then they gave Goma some milk and cat food, which she eagerly tucked into.
"My apologies for coming so late at night. It would be much better to come earlier, but Nakata couldn't help it."
"That's all right," Mrs. Koizumi said. "Please don't worry about it."
"Don't worry about the time," her husband said. "That cat is like a member of the family. I can't tell you how happy we are you could find her. Won't you come in and have a cup of tea?"
"No, thank you. Nakata must be going. I just wanted to get Goma back to you as soon as possible."
Mrs. Koizumi went to another room and returned with Nakata's fee in an envelope, which her husband handed to Nakata. "It's not much, but please accept this token for all you've done. We're very grateful."
"Thank you very much. Much obliged," Nakata said, and bowed.
"I'm surprised, though, you could find her in the dark like this."
"Yes, it's a long story. Nakata can't tell you it all. I'm not too bright, and not so good at giving long explanations."
"That's quite all right. We are so grateful to you, Mr. Nakata," Mrs. Koizumi said. "I'm sorry it's just leftovers, but we have some grilled aubergine and vinegared cucumbers we'd like you to take home with you."
"I'd be happy to. Grilled aubergine and vinegared cucumbers are some of Nakata's favorites."
Nakata stowed the Tupperware container and the envelope in his bag. He walked quickly towards the station and went to a police box near the shopping district. A young officer was seated at a desk inside, working intently on some papers. His hat was on the desk. Nakata slid open the glass door.
"Good evening. Sorry to bother you," he said.
"Good evening," the policeman replied. He looked up from the paperwork and gave Nakata a once-over. "Basically a nice, harmless old man," was his professional assessment, most likely stopping to ask directions. Standing at the entrance, Nakata removed his hat and stuffed it in his pocket, then took a handkerchief from the other pocket and blew his nose. He folded up the handkerchief and put it back. "Is there something I can do for you?" the policeman asked.
"Yes, there is. I just murdered somebody."
The policeman dropped his pen on the desk and stared open-mouthed at the old man. For a moment he was speechless.
"What the...
Here, why don't you sit down?" he said dubiously, pointing to a chair opposite him. He reached out and checked that he had his pistol, baton, and handcuffs on him.
Thank you,
Nakata said, and sat down. Back held straight, hands resting in his lap, he looked straight at the officer.
So what you're saying is, you killed somebody?
Yes, Nakata killed a person with a knife just a little while ago,
Nakata admitted frankly. The young officer took out a form, glanced at the clock on the wall, and noted down the time and the statement about a knifing.
I'll need your name and address.
My name is Satoru Nakata, and my address is...
Just a moment. What characters do you write your name with?
I don't know about characters. I'm sorry, but I can't write or read either.
The officer frowned.
You're telling me you can't read at all? You can't even write your name?
That's correct. Until I was 9, I could read and write, but then there was an accident, and after that I can't. Nakata's not too bright.
The officer sighed and laid down his pen.
I can't fill out the form if I don't know how your name is written.
I apologize.
Do you have any family?
Nakata's all alone. I have no family. And no job. I live on a sub-city from the governor.
It's pretty late, and I suggest you go on home. Go home and get a good night's sleep, and then tomorrow, if you remember something, come and see me again. We can talk then.
The policeman was nearing the end of his shift and wanted to finish up all his paperwork before he went off duty. He'd promised to meet a fellow officer for a drink at a nearby bar when he got off, so the last thing he wanted to do was waste time talking to some crazy old coot. But Nakata gave him a harsh look and shook his head.
No, sir. Nakata wants to tell everything while he still remembers it. If I wait until tomorrow, I might forget something important. Nakata was in the empty plot of land in the Tuchome section. The Koizumis had asked me to find their missing cat, Goma. Then a huge black dog appeared out of the blue and took me to a house. A big house with a big gate and a black car. I don't know the address. I've never been to that part of town before. But I'm pretty sure it's in Nakano Ward. Inside the house was a man named Johnny Walker, who had on a funny black hat. A very high sort of hat. In the fridge in the kitchen, there were rows of cat's heads. About 20 or so, I'd say. He collects cats, cuts off their heads with a saw, and eats their hearts. He's collecting the cat's souls to make a special kind of flute, and then he's going to use that flute to collect people's souls. Right in front of Nakata, Johnny Walker killed Mr. Kawamura with a knife, and several other cats. He cut open their stomachs with a knife. He was going to kill Goma and Mimi, too. But then Nakata used a knife to kill Johnny Walker. Johnny Walker said he wanted Nakata to kill him. But I didn't mean to kill him. I've never killed anybody before. I just wanted to stop Johnny Walker from killing any more cats. But my body wouldn't listen. It did what it wanted. I picked up one of the knives there and stabbed Johnny Walker 2 times. Johnny Walker fell down, covered with blood, and died. Nakata got all bloody then, too. I sat on the sofa and must have fallen asleep. When I woke up, it was the middle of the night, and I was back in the empty plot of land. Mimi and Goma were beside me. That was just a while ago. Nakata took Goma back, got some grilled aubergine and vinegared cucumbers from Mrs. Koizumi, and came directly here. And I thought I'd better report to the governor right away. Tell him what happened.
Nakata sat up straight through this whole recitation, and when he'd finished he took a deep breath. He'd never spoken this much in one spurt in his life. He felt drained.
So please report this to the governor,
he added. The young policeman had listened to the whole story with a vacant look, and didn't understand much of what the old man was getting at. Goma? Johnny Walker?
I understand, he replied. I'll make sure the governor hears of this.
I hope he doesn't cut off my subsidy.
Looking displeased, the policeman pretended to fill out a form.
I understand. I'll write it down just like that. The person in question desires that his subsidy will not be cut off. Is that all right, then?
Yes, that's fine. Much obliged. Sorry to take up your time. And please say hello to the governor for me.
Will do. So don't worry and just take it easy today, okay? The policeman said. He couldn't help adding a personal aside. You know, your clothes look pretty clean for having killed someone and got all bloody. There's not a spot on you.
Yes, you're entirely correct. To tell the truth, Nagata finds it very strange, too. It doesn't make any sense. I should be covered in blood, but when I looked, it had all disappeared. It's very strange.
It certainly is, the policeman said, his voice tinged with an entire day's worth of exhaustion.
Nakata slid open the door and was about to leave when he stopped and turned round.
Excuse me, sir, but will you be in this area tomorrow evening?
Yes, I will, the policeman replied cautiously. I'm on duty here tomorrow evening. Why do you ask?
Even if it's sunny, I suggest you bring an umbrella.
The policeman nodded. He turned and looked at the clock. His colleague should be phoning any minute now.
Okay, I'll be sure to bring one.
There will be fish falling from the sky like rain. A lot of fish. Mostly sardines, I believe, with a few mackerel mixed in.
Sardines and mackerel, eh? The policeman laughed. Better turn the umbrella upside down, then, and catch a few. With vinegar, it would make a meal.
Vinegared mackerel's one of Nakata's favourites,
Nakata said with a serious look.
But by that time tomorrow, I believe I'll be gone.
The next day when, sure enough, sardines and mackerel rained down on a section of Nakano Ward, the young policeman turned white as a sheet. With no warning whatsoever, some 2,000 sardines and mackerel plunged to earth from the clouds. Most of the fish were crushed to a pulp as they slammed into the ground, but a few survived and flopped around on the road by the shopping district. The fish were fresh, still with the smell of the sea about them. The fish struck people, cars and roofs, but not apparently from such a great height, so no serious injuries resulted. It was more shocking than anything else. A huge number of fish falling like hail from the sky. It was positively apocalyptic. The police investigated the matter, but could come up with no plausible explanation for how it happened. No fish market or fishing boat reported any large number of sardines and mackerel missing. No planes or helicopters were flying overhead at the time. Neither were there any reports of tornadoes. They dismissed the possibility that it was some elaborate practical joke. Who would possibly do something so utterly bizarre? At the request of the police, the Nakano Ward Health Office collected some of the fish and examined them, but found nothing unusual. They were just ordinary sardines and mackerel, fresh and good to eat by the looks of them. All the same, the police, afraid these mystery fish might contain some dangerous substance, sent out a loudspeaker van around the neighbourhood, warning people not to eat any. This was the kind of story TV news programmes lapped up, and crews rushed to the scene. Journalists crowded around the shopping district and sent out their reports on this curious event across the nation. They scooped up fish with shovels to illustrate what had happened. They also interviewed a housewife who had been struck on the head by one of the falling mackerel, the dorsal fin cutting her cheek. "I'm just glad it wasn't a tuna," she said, pressing a handkerchief to her cheek. That made sense, but still viewers chuckled. One of the more adventuresome journalists grilled some of the fish on the spot.
"Delicious," he told viewers proudly. "Very fresh, with just the right amount of fat. Too bad I don't have any grated radish and hot rice to round out the meal."
The policeman was baffled. The strange old codger, what was his name again, had predicted these fish raining from the sky. Sardines and mackerel, just as he'd said. "But I laughed it off," the policeman thought, "and didn't even get his name and address." Should he tell his boss about it? He supposed so. But then again, what good would it do now? Nobody really got hurt, and there is no proof that a crime has been committed.